Was the United States founded as a Christian nation? That's a question a lot of American Christians have asked over the past century or more, and it's a question a lot of Christians have disagreed about. Part of the disagreement is probably because people can mean different things by the term Christian nation. Do you mean that the term, by that term, that our government was explicitly founded on Christianity and that all citizens and government officials were required to be Christians? Or do you mean that our major founding fathers were all mostly Christians? Or do you mean that most of the population at the time of the American Revolution were Christians? Or maybe you mean that our form of government reflects biblical principles and that its founders, whether or not they were individually Christian, largely embraced a biblical worldview when it came to human nature, morality, and society. I actually think this last view is very well supported by the historical record. Yet it might surprise you that some of the other definitions of a Christian nation are more debatable. For example, were all of the major founding fathers Christians? Well, some certainly were. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, was a devout evangelical who became president, in fact, of the American Bible Society. His private letters are replete with his passion about the gospel and about the New Testament. Some other founders, of course, definitely weren't Christians, like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and actually John Adams. Jefferson and Adams were both Unitarians who categorically rejected the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus. As Adams wrote to Jefferson late in life, "Had you and I been 40 days with Moses on Mount Sinai, and there told that there three is one and one is three, we might not have had courage to deny it, but we could not have believed it. We should be more likely to say in our hearts, this is chance, there is no God, no truth." The religious views of still other founding fathers were ambiguous. As a college student, James Madison was definitely a committed Christian. But as an adult, we really don't have a lot of evidence about his private beliefs. And consider George Washington, whose legacy has often been fought over by different Christian groups, claiming him for themselves. Now, Washington clearly devoutly believed in God, but whether he believed in Jesus is another matter. As an adult, it's pretty well established that he would leave church before communion, so he didn't have to partake in it. His wife stayed, but he would leave. Now, that's a very odd thing to do if you accept Jesus as your Savior. Communion is one of two mandatory sacraments accepted by pretty much all groups of Christians. What about the American population as a whole? Were they all Christians during the founding of America? Well, in 1776, it's estimated that less than 1 in 5 Americans were members or even seriously affiliated with a church. Less than 1 in 5. And by the 1790s, shortly after the new Constitution had been adopted, many Americans were smitten with the secular ideals of the French Revolution and the progressive teachings of Unitarianism. By the early 1800s, in fact, Unitarians who rejected Jesus as God would take over many of the congregations in New England, originally established by the Puritans. But now here's the really interesting fact. Fast forward from 1776 to 1860, and you will notice a vast change in the landscape. Maybe America at its founding wasn't a Christian nation by some definitions, but America by the 1850s certainly seemed to be. In 1776, an estimated only 17% of Americans were adherents to a church, any church. By 1860, it was 37%. That was an increase of 118%. So what happened? Did federal and state governments suddenly start funding churches and ministers? Did legislative assemblies start enacting laws decreeing that Christianity was the state religion and that people were legally required to follow it? No. In fact, almost the opposite happened. An increasing number of states repealed religious requirements for elected officials, and state-supported churches were largely defunded, even in places like New England, the old haunt of the Puritans. Increasingly, American Christians could no longer rely on government support for their churches or their beliefs. In the words of evangelical minister Lyman Beecher, this new era cut the churches loose from dependence on state support. It threw them wholly on their own resources and on God. What transpired next is commonly described by historians as the Second Great Awakening, referring to a series of evangelical revivals that started in the Northeast but ultimately spread to the Western frontier. But the revivals tell only a part of the story. They were paralleled by a mass infusion of evangelical Christians into the public arena, where they organized scores of voluntary associations to preach the gospel, diminish poverty, curb crime, and curb practices like dueling that actually Glenn Sunshine talked about. The reason we don't have dueling right now in the United States is not because of the government, it's pretty much because of a crusade by evangelical Christians from about 1800 to 1850 in America, and to reduce alcoholism. The Second Great Awakening was a messy affair, and the theology of some parts of it certainly can be debated. Nevertheless, on the whole, these scores of voluntary associations organized for evangelism, missions, and social and political reform transformed America in a way that few government programs could. The Reverend Lyman Beecher was one of the chief theoreticians of this movement for cultural renewal by Christians, delivering a series of sermons articulating a system that one more recent historian has dubbed America's voluntary establishment of religion. Government used to promote civic virtue by compelling people to support the gospel and attend the public worship of God, Beecher told an audience of legislators in Connecticut. But then he went on, but these means of moral influence, of government compelling people to worship God or uphold Christianity, these means of moral influence the law can no longer apply, said Beecher, and there is no substitute but the voluntary energies of the nation itself in associations for charitable contributions and efforts patronized by all denominations of Christians and by all classes of the community who love their country. Beecher advocated replacing government support of religion and morality with a network of voluntary societies that would spread the gospel, inculcate moral habits in the young, and reclaim the dissolute. In those cases where government action was still necessary, these associations would seek to create a public consensus through educational efforts, because in a free society, Beecher realized, persuasion needs to precede coercion. Years later, Beecher made this comment. They say, or some say, that ministers have lost their influence. The fact is, they have gained. By voluntary efforts, societies, missions, and revivals, they exert a deeper influence than they ever could have by state support. Visiting the United States during the early 1830s, Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville saw these voluntary efforts firsthand and later wrote about how Americans were forever forming associations. The far-reaching network of private groups established by evangelical Christians helped reshape American society before the Civil War and enthroned evangelical Protestantism as the de facto religion of American culture. Three of the most influential reform efforts were Sunday schools, temperance societies, and anti-poverty programs. I want to talk about each of them briefly because they give a picture of just how dramatically American evangelicals impacted the society and culture of their day. Then I'm going to shift and talk about today for most of my talk, but I want to give you this background of what's possible, because in the 1800s, really, there's a dramatic story of what happened that most even American Christians today don't know about. So first, there were Sunday schools. This was during a time when public education was virtually non-existent in many areas, particularly on the Western frontier. Sunday schools formed the backbone of education in many communities, teaching both children and adults to read and instructing them in the principles of morality and Christianity. In 1828, an estimated 127,000 pupils attended Sunday school classes. By 1835, that figure had spiraled to 1 million. 1 million with a lot of students even today, and 1 million out of the population size in 1835 was huge. All of whom were taught to do this required an extensive infrastructure of 16,000 Sunday schools and more than 130,000 teachers, all of whom volunteered their time without remuneration. Some of the more prominent Sunday school teachers in antebellum America included President William Henry Harrison. The vast majority of Sunday schools were affiliated with the American Sunday School Union, which spearheaded an aggressive program to spread their classes into new areas of the country and published vast quantities of reading material, basically based on Christianity, reading material in the hope of reforming the character of Americans' children's literature at the time. By 1830, the Union had produced at least 250 separate works. 46 of these had been released within the previous year, adding over 6,000 pages of new reading material. So that was Sunday schools. Then there were the temperance societies. Now, I realize Christians have different views about whether you can drink alcohol. I myself don't think it's wrong, even though I choose not to drink for a variety of reasons relating to my family. But Christians have pretty much agreed that getting drunk or being ruled or ruined by alcohol is wrong. In early 19th century America, there was a lot of alcohol-induced devastation among families, and societies, and on crime and other things, a lot of alcohol-induced devastation for Christians to be concerned about. It's even true today, if you think about drunk driving or think about a lot of criminal activities that are under the influence of either alcohol or other forms of drugs. So that's why many Christians decided to act. By 1828, more than 400 temperance societies had been established across the United States, including statewide ones in New Hampshire, Vermont, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Illinois. These societies sought to educate the public about the extent of alcohol abuse and to educate and persuade people either to drink less or to abstain. Many local societies pointed to significant drops in liquor consumption as proof of their effectiveness. I'm going to give you one stat, pretty amazing stat, in just a few moments that shows the impact they made. A third example of voluntary reform efforts I want to look at, there were anti-poverty programs, which today we pretty much think of, well, the government handles that. It doesn't necessarily need to handle that. In the 1800s, a number of local evangelical groups focused on helping and educating the poor, but these explicit efforts to help the hardcore poor were only a small part of evangelical anti-poverty efforts of the era. More informally, working-class people who were drawn to evangelical churches found that they now had access to a variety of resources that could help them improve their economic status, as one study of revivals in Rochester, New York has shown. This was a secular study that I'm going to talk about. What this researcher found was that wealthy church members in Rochester organized a savings bank for the benefit of the working classes, and then they provided capital for building and for early and budding entrepreneurs among Christian working class people by forming business partnerships with them. As a result of these measures and the personal sort of discipline and industry instilled by biblical morality, converts from the working classes experienced a profound upward mobility. And now I'm quoting from the study. Of the clerks who joined churches during the revivals and who remained in Rochester in 1837, 72% became merchants, professionals, or shopkeepers. Similar efforts were made to assist impoverished women. Key associations in this area included New York's Association for the Relief of Respectable Aged and Indigent Females, the Society for Employing the Female Poor in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Magdalen Societies in both New York and Philadelphia that sought to rescue women from prostitution. Female reform societies served as a kind of informal employment agency for needy young women. Wealthy female members of these societies worked to find positions for young girls in the households of their friends. Participation in these evangelical voluntary associations reached phenomenal levels before the Civil War in major population centers such as New York City. By 1829, more than 40% of the children, more than 40% of the children in New York City between the ages of 4 and 14 attended Sunday schools. By 1860, nearly half of all adult Protestant males in the city were members of at least one church-related voluntary association. The impact of this wave of reform efforts could also be seen on Americans' consumption of alcohol, which had risen dramatically in the early 1800s and was fostering brawling, rioting, and all sorts of other forms, family dissolution, and other forms of civil disorder in America's cities. By 1850, after decades of temperance efforts, and this was years before the misguided effort of a national, you know, constitutional amendment making this illegal, but by 1850, after decades of voluntary temperance efforts, per capita consumption of alcohol in America had plummeted by 80%. Now, some social reforms do require laws. Don't deny that. Laws to establish justice, laws to protect the innocent, and laws are based on, it should be based on a true view of morality. But the point I'm trying to make here is that culture is just not, it's not just politics, and it's not simply dictated by government or law. Everyone has a hand in creating culture, and that includes Christians in their churches. Despite all that is currently happening today, Bible-believing Christians throughout the United States still have more freedom to influence and shape our culture than in many other places in the world. And the experience of American evangelicals in the first half of the 19th century provides a roadmap, a strategy for what can be achieved. So for the rest of my talk, I'm now going to focus on four areas where Christians today can shape our culture, not by government actions or laws primarily, but by our own voluntary efforts, just like the Christians of the early 1800s. So the first area I want to mention is the public celebration of national holidays. In some ways, when it comes to culture, we are what we celebrate. What we celebrate shows what we value. If we celebrate consumerism or depraved behaviors, that shows what our culture values. And unfortunately, in America today, our public celebrations are increasingly secular, consumer-oriented, and, yes, depraved. But these public celebrations aren't dictated primarily by the government. They are shaped by everyone. And Christians, if they choose, can have a hand in reshaping what our culture chooses to celebrate. There's a famous picture from March 1956 that has circulated on the internet for a number of years now. Many people find the picture so strange, so utterly bizarre, that they think it must be fake. So many people have wondered about the photo that Snopes.com has even done a fact check of it. But you know what? According to Snopes, the picture is genuine. And just what is in this utterly bizarre picture? It shows three skyscrapers in the New York City Financial District on Easter weekend, 1956. The windows of each skyscraper are lit up to create a giant cross for all to see. Three giant crosses representing Jesus and the thieves crucified on Good Friday, displayed for hundreds of thousands of people to see on Easter weekend. Actually, these crosses were ultimately seen by millions of Americans because the United Press Service took a photo of the crosses and sent it out on the newswire to hundreds of newspapers across the country, many of which republished it Easter weekend. This was a public demonstration, a stunning public demonstration of the true meaning of the holiday. But here's the thing, those skyscrapers weren't government buildings. They were privately owned. And they provide a glimmer of what is possible if Christians really want to create a culture that publicly honors Christ. America recognizes at least five holidays with roots in Christianity. Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, Mother's Day, and Father's Day. You may not realize it, but Mother's Day was initiated as a church celebration by a Methodist woman, Anna Jarvis. And Father's Day was initiated by a Methodist woman in our own state, Sonora Smart Dodd. Sonora was from Spokane, and after hearing a Mother's Day sermon in her church, she convinced the Spokane Ministerial Association to create a day in their churches to honor godly fathers as well. So that's something we can be proud of, I guess, in Washington State. There are increasingly few of those things today. Anyway, so Father's Day. Each of these Christian-inspired holidays has been largely taken over by secular culture and drained of its Christian content, but that can change. Here's just a simple list of things that Christians can do right now to create public celebrations that honor Christ and biblical truth relating to holidays. One thing Christians can do is march. Throughout history, public marches and processions have been ways to celebrate as a community, celebrate marriages, celebrate great events, celebrate holidays. Even today, many communities have Christmas or holiday or Thanksgiving parades. In most American cities, these are completely secular. But that doesn't have to be the case. In many countries throughout history, Christians have held public nativity and Holy Week processions. They do that in some places of the world still today. Processions through the public streets that point to the true meaning of Christmas and Easter. Right now, Christians in America can sponsor their own parades on public streets as public events to celebrate Christmas and Easter, to recognize and honor families, and even to explicitly proclaim Jesus as Lord. Starting in England in the 1980s, Christians from England, and then it spread around the world, began to hold annual marches for Jesus in their communities. One year in the 1990s, 1.5 million Americans in 550 cities across our country participated. I remember being with Sonia on our honeymoon in 1997 in the English village of Glastonbury, when suddenly, out of nowhere, we heard people publicly singing Christian songs. We were visiting a historic site and heard this and went over to the street, and lo and behold, there were Christians marching in a procession for Jesus in the middle of really unchurched England. It was quite inspiring. In Sao Paulo, Brazil, the annual March for Jesus drew 5 million people in 2010 and 2011. As long as these marches and processions are sponsored by private groups, those private groups will have control over the message of their marches. And they can exclude groups that want to disrupt their message. The U.S. Supreme Court made that clear in a unanimous ruling back in 1995. So, for example, if you want to organize a Mother's Day parade to celebrate godly mothers, you don't have to accept as part of the parade group a group that denies the reality of biological sex. But parades aren't the only way to shape a community celebration. You can sponsor your own block parties, street festivals, and special events. In the church where I grew up, the church choir joined with choirs from three other churches each Advent to put on a community Christmas choral concert. It became one of the community's signature Christmas events, drawing large crowds. Some years ago, I was part of a church in Tacoma Stadium District where there was a holiday parade that was going to go in front of the church. So we opened up the church's courtyard during the parade to offer people free hot cider, and then we invited parade watchers to attend a Christmas concert where the gospel was presented in our church once the parade was over. Following that, for many years, the Stadium District Business Association has sponsored a Dickens Street Festival, and for many years, this church planned Christmas concert that, again, focused on the true meaning of Christmas that were recognized as an official part of that festival. Post-COVID shutdowns, I think there is a renewed hunger for live in-person events where people can gather together and mingle as members of the community. There is a strategic opportunity here that Christians in America can use to reshape culture into something better. These sort of community events organized by Christians used to be very common, even here in the secularized Pacific Northwest. But they seem to have become far less common as many Christians have retreated into their own sealed communities. Sometimes it takes someone with a fresh perspective to see the opportunity. Less than 10 minutes away from where I live, there is a large Slavic Bible church. Most of their services are not in English. These are mostly, you know, immigrants and their children who were born here. But they have decided to do large musical events featuring all of their youth, their an orchestra, all sorts of things, in English each year, once at Christmas and the other at Easter. Those concerts focus on the true meaning of Christmas and Easter, and they present the gospel, but they are framed as community celebrations. Members of the church invite friends and neighbors. They even go out into the streets. I was even once at a gas station where someone went to and gave me a card, go to this event, to invite people to come. Their whole church is involved in these elaborate productions, which include, like I said, mass choir, orchestra, followed by a reception with food cooked, extraordinary food cooked and prepared by the members of the church. The same church earlier this month held a neighborhood barbecue with music, food, and activities. Again, the community was invited. These Christians are making their church a focal point for community gatherings for the right reasons. And in so doing, they are shaping the culture of their local community and what their local community celebrates. You can also shape celebrations through public displays. Sometimes these displays can be on public property, like a park or town square, if that park or property is open for displays by private groups, and many public grounds are, with the right permits. But you don't need for the displays to be on public property to make a public impact. Churches, businesses, and individual homes can all put up displays that can change the atmosphere around a celebration. Instead of Santa or the Easter Bunny, Christians can publicly display nativity scenes, crosses, banners of the empty tomb, and even project images on buildings of Bible verses or scenes from the Bible. Imagine if every Christian business owner, every Christian homeowner, made it a priority that in their holiday celebrations, in their holiday imagery, they actually put up things focusing on the true meaning of those holidays. The government can't stop that. A lot of people might be upset, but tough. I mean, this is part of your voluntary right to honor things, and it helps create a different atmosphere about what is focused on. If we want to, Christians can also create our own monuments and memorials. In the Old Testament, monuments were a way to commemorate something God had done. There's been a lot of conflict over the past few decades over monuments to things like the Ten Commandments on public property, and in many cases, those have not been allowed anymore by our courts. That doesn't mean Christians need to be silenced. Many churches or individual Christians already own strategically located pieces of property, perhaps on their town's main street or at a major intersection or across from a public park. You can place your monument on private property and still establish a clear public presence. One of my favorite examples of this is called Desert Christ Park in a city out in the California desert. This park started with the vision of a pastor and a sculptor who wanted to create giant statues of the life of Jesus placed on a hill for all to see from miles around. Desert Christ Park still exists, and it draws visitors from all over the world now. After the sculptor's death, the property was bequeathed for a time to the local government for a public park, which provoked the ACLU to sue. The ACLU won that suit. But Desert Christ Park was not shut down. It was returned to private ownership, and today it still is a privately run park for the public, and it still attracts visitors from everywhere. It is a monument in the California desert that recognizes the centrality of Christ. Another example of how Christians can retake public celebrations that have become increasingly secularized, public performances. At one time, churches throughout America had bell towers. These bell towers called people to church, they marked public holidays, they tolled in memory of people, including public figures, when they died. Bell towers gave way to tubular bells and chimes, which allowed you to play hymns that your neighborhood and city would hear on Sunday mornings, Christmas Eve, and other important days. Probably the most prolific producer of tubular bells for churches in the 20th century was the J.C. Deegan Company of Illinois. From the 1920s through the 1950s, the Deegan Company installed tower chimes in over 400 churches throughout the United States. The church where I was a member in the Stadium District was one of those churches. Their tubular bells still worked thanks to a couple of dedicated church members who had rebuilt them and maintained them. It was one of my great joys until the chimes broke again to play hymns on them before and after each service and before the Christmas Eve service. So until just a few years ago, Wright Park and the neighborhoods surrounding that church would hear the sounds of Christian hymns on Sunday and sacred holidays. But you don't need a bell tower to create a public performance. Think about a more modern example, flash mobs that take over public spaces, not to riot, but to sing and make music. Several years ago, there was a series of shopping malls where flash mobs performed songs like Amazing Grace and the Hallelujah Chorus around Christmas time. If you look up Flash on YouTube, Flash Mob and Hallelujah Chorus, in fact, you'll find one of these takeovers of a shopping mall that now has 55 million views on YouTube. So these are just a few ideas about how Christians today can use our religious freedom to refocus public celebrations on things that honor God. But now let me address three additional areas of culture beside public celebrations: marriage, education, and leadership development. How might Christians using their First Amendment freedom seek to forge a culture that promotes and defends biblical marriage? Well, through the 1990s, over 60% of Americans were married in religious wedding ceremonies. 50% of those ceremonies were in actual churches or places of worship, while another 13% were in secular venues but officiated by a minister or religious leader. Michael McManus is a Christian who was a journalist in his career. In the 1980s, he and his wife Harriet grew concerned about the dramatic rise of divorce in America. They had an intriguing idea. Most Americans, they noted, unlike most people in Europe at the time, still wanted to get married in a church or at least in a wedding officiated by a minister. They thought this gave churches and pastors strategic leverage to influence the marriages that would take place in their communities. What would happen, the McManuses wondered, if you got all of the ministers in a community to pledge that they would not marry anyone without insisting on serious premarital counseling and also on supplying mentor couples who would help newly married people if they faced problems? In 1986, Modesto, California was the first city where the McManuses were able to convince local clergy to adopt such a community marriage policy. The divorce rate in Modesto was cut by over half for quite some number of years. Ultimately, more than 200 community marriage policies were adopted in cities across the United States. According to one independent study, these community marriage policies, on average, resulted in a cut in the divorce rate by close to 18%. In several cities like Modesto, depending on whether you got the majority of churches and religious leaders involved, the divorce rate was dropped by 50% or more. In El Paso, Texas, the divorce rate plunged 79% after clergy adopted the policy. Christians in these communities changed their culture by taking their responsibilities to support marriage seriously and acting together. Could this work today? Maybe. One challenge is that fewer people today in America want a religious marriage ceremony. According to a 2022 survey, only 30% of people married in the previous decade had marriages in churches or places of worship. On the other hand, another 18% got married in a non-religious venue, but at a ceremony officiated by a minister or religious leader. So that's still nearly half of all marriages in America either taking place at a church or at least being officiated by a minister. So what would happen if churches and ministers today agreed to adopt a community marriage policy? The results on culture, depending on the community, could still be dramatic. Now let's look at another area of culture where Christians can exert their influence by voluntary means, education. Raising children is a primary God-given function of families, so educating children is a key part of our culture, one it increasingly does a terrible job at. Social media platforms and Hollywood want to raise your children in ways that will destroy them. Public schools are often no better, depending on your community. So how can Christians help change the culture here using our First Amendment freedoms? Of course, the most obvious ways include starting private Christian schools and supporting homeschools and homeschool co-ops. I'm delighted that my home church, this church, actually is now involved in sponsoring both a K-12 Christian school in cooperation with other churches, but also a ministry to assist homeschoolers. We aren't alone. This past spring, my son and I were at an event in Chicago for African-American Christians, where an African-American pastor shared how his Chicago church had a vision of providing their own Christian schools as an alternative to the corrupt public education system in that city. In the summer, I met a pastor from the Bronx whose church is doing something similar for inner-city youth in New York City. But Christians can also use their First Amendment freedoms to influence the public schools. In many states, Christians can start publicly funded charter schools that are faith-friendly and teach morality that's consistent with the Bible. At the same conference I attended where there was the African-American pastor sharing about creating private schools in Chicago, another African-American Christian from New York City shared about his mission of creating charter schools, and actually has created charter schools in New York City that reflect a biblical worldview. But you don't have to start a charter school to influence public education either. There are frequently one or more churches across the street or down the block from a public school. That's a very strategic location. For high school students, a nearby church can offer an alternative school lunch program once a week to draw on students for encouragement and fellowship. For grade school students, a church next door could offer supervised after-school activities that integrate a Christian worldview. Many working parents are desperate for after-school options for their children. Churches can fill that void. It's a strategic opportunity. But your church doesn't need to be next to a public school to shape public education either. In many public school districts, Christian students have the right to create on-campus clubs for the Bible, studying the Bible, or apologetics, or other Christian activities. Those clubs can be outposts for the kingdom in those schools. There are even more ways Christians can influence public schools. Public schools can't officially have baccalaureate services for their graduating seniors. But that doesn't matter. Churches can band together and create such services themselves. I attended Federal Way Public Schools. In that district, there was a baccalaureate service that encouraged students in their Christian faith that pretty much huge numbers of students attended. But this service was sponsored by churches, not the school district. It wasn't officially a school event. But when teachers who are Christians, school officials, and student leaders all attend, it becomes, for all practical purposes, a school event. But because it's privately sponsored and attendance is voluntary, it's allowable. But it still makes a difference in the culture of that school. Or consider doing a back-to-school prayer rally. Such an event was held in my hometown of Federal Way in 1998. The prayer rally was publicized by stories in the local newspaper. It was promoted by the superintendent of the school district, who was a Christian at the time, who even spoke at the event as a, you know, as a private citizen, but he was the superintendent. There were no legal threats over this event, yet it took place in the public high school stadium, was a community event, and was promoted by a school official in his private capacity. For all practical purposes, again, this was a civic celebration. But its official sponsor was a group of community, primarily church leaders, rather than the government. In short, the event was what might be called privately sponsored public speech. Speech and activities are in the public square, but are not officially sponsored by the government, so it was perfectly allowable. One last area where churches can shape culture. And there are many more. I'm picking four because I have limited time, and you'll probably be more than ready for lunch so by the time I'm done. One of the biggest problems with our culture today is not that Christians aren't in places of leadership in the culture. There are, in fact, plenty of Christians who have positions of influence in the media, the arts, education, science, politics, and more. The problem is that many of these Christians tend to be what I described last night, Stockholm Syndrome Christians. They identify more with secular culture than with biblical Christianity. So they don't help reform existing culture, they help extend it. But who is responsible for this situation? These Stockholm Syndrome Christians in culturally influential positions attend churches, even biblical churches, but they obviously aren't getting what they need to lead a cultural transformation. I just think there, I didn't actually have this in my talk, but I'll just add it because it really is emblematic of this. A few weeks ago, there was a prayer day gathering, you know, prayer breakfast, and one of the featured speakers was Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who says, and I trust has become a Christian. Well, she started off her talk with a joke of, you know, how hard it was to get there because when she woke up with her live-in boyfriend next, he wanted to, you know, do what married people are supposed to do, but she had to say, well, no, you have to wait because I need to get to this prayer breakfast, and then, you know, that has to be wait in the day. She thought that was funny. I think it's sad. But it raises a question less about Nancy Grace than she goes to an evangelical, supposedly evangelical church. All of these Stockholm Syndrome Christians, many of whom are identified as evangelical Christians and do go to an evangelically oriented church. So the question I have is not, I do question where they're coming from, but then questioning, why are they that way? What are they not getting in their churches? Christians, and I think churches, need to be more intentional about recruiting and training leaders, including future leaders. I know of one church in the Dallas area that now offers its high school students a gap year experience where they volunteer for the church, but they also receive worldview training that equips them to help shape the culture in their chosen fields in years to come. Other churches and paratroops groups, like the Charles Colson Center, that was actually, that Glenn mentioned, their program, the Colson Fellows program, of offering programs for Christian professionals to help equip them to stand for Christ in the culture. Here at ERC, we have our own Eric Cooper, who had this vision for providing training and equipping in the area of cultural formation. That's how this annual conference got started. Leadership training is about how you transform the culture over the long haul. It's the approach Jesus himself used when he mentored a small group of disciples who then proclaimed the good news around the world. They then mentored others who mentored others. I've seen this approach work firsthand in my work at Discovery Institute. For over 15 years, I've helped direct a summer program that trains graduate students and professionals who want to impact debates over faith and science. We're now beginning to see students we've mentored become and make their own mark on the world, getting tenure as tenured professors, as writers, as public intellectuals. And that's really powerful to see what God can do over time. If you equip people and you mentor people, God can use that. So to conclude, I want to say, in today's culture, a lot of things are bleak. But part of the problem is, I think, Christians too often equate public life with just the activities of the government or politics. And as a former political science professor, believe me, I don't discount the importance of politics or having Christians in politics or having a Christian view of politics. Nonetheless, as 19th century evangelicals realized in America, the public square encompasses far more than government, and private individuals and groups can provide public goods when the government cannot or will not. Christians don't need to depend on the top down to reform the culture. We can start reforming the culture right now from the bottom up.